Hi, I'm Monse, and this is Musings of the Artist, a podcast where I have meaningful conversations with all kinds of artists, musicians, writers, painters, photographers, and other creatives share their honest stories, touching on the duality of being creative, the pure joy of making art, but also the particular struggles that come with it.
I found that the greatest cure for that kind of trauma is not to try to address it as a pathology and try to withdraw into the self and try to take care of oneself. And for me, the greatest cure, the thing that pulls you out of it, is doing something for others outside yourself and focusing on others and committing yourself to something that's beyond the self. So the self doesn't have a chance to get so much in control and so dominant, and you know, and you don't then so much risk pathologizing yourself and infantilizing yourself or babying yourself. I'm not saying that you shouldn't do self-care. I'm just saying that sometimes the greatest cure for depression is, or that kind of depression that comes from experiencing certain events, is to do something, to do something, you know, to make some difference somehow, to have a positive effect on the world in some, even a small way.
Carolyn Forché is a poet, translator, and activist whose work has been translated into over 20 languages. Her books of poetry are Blue Hour, The Angel of History, The Country Between Us, Gathering the Tribes, and In the Lateness of the World. Her memoir, What You Have Heard Is True, describes her time in El Salvador shortly before and during the civil war there. And it was a finalist for the 2019 National Book Award for Nonfiction. Carolyn is also a co-chair with Gloria Steinem of Hedgebrook's Creative Advisory Council. In this conversation, we talk about her incredible story on being a witness to such pain and suffering and the myth of closure. We talk about the art of writing and the emotional aspect of publication. She tells us the greatest cure for our own pain is to have a positive effect on the world, even in some small way, and I wholeheartedly agree. Getting to speak with Carolyn was such an honor, and I'm so grateful to be able to share it with you. If you haven't read her memoir yet, it's truly extraordinary, which is a word I think I used maybe 10 times throughout our conversation. Anyway, it's such an important read that will change you. Just a little note, the audio quality is a little messy at the very beginning of the recording, which, you know, sometimes happens during these remote recordings, but it does get better. Okay, I'm going to stop talking, and here is my conversation with Carolyn. Awesome. Oh my gosh, I'm so honored to talk to you. And I have to tell you, before we even get started into the full interview, a couple crazy coincidences. So as I was reading your book, I almost got dizzy when I read the part that you spent a summer in Mallorca in Deia, because that's actually my family's village.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I grew up going there every summer and on all vacations and all that. My grandmother and great-grandmother are buried in the little cemetery.
I know the cemetery.
Yes, yes. I'm sure you do.
You go up there a lot. So I was there in 77. Were you born yet?
I was born in 82. Okay. And I was trying to think about, because my parents were married there the summer of 79. And for a moment I thought, oh, is it the same summer you were there? But I realized it was 2 years earlier.
Yeah.
But it's very likely that, you know, you walked by my parents at some point that summer.
It's so very crazy. Likely that I knew your grandmother. I knew a lot of the grandmothers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Her name was
older women. Yeah.
Oh, I bet. It's so funny. I don't know. Have you been back?
I haven't been back.
Wow, it's so different. It's sad.
Is it bad?
What's sad to me about it is just that, you know, it's tourists are there all the time now, and it's a different place. It's I am actually writing a whole piece on it right now.
Wow.
Because, you know, it's there's a certain sadness, right? When it's like this place has been this oasis for me all these years,
and a place of calm. And, you know, I wrote in the piece, like, this moment that I felt really sad was when, I think it was a year or two ago. I go back every year, and I was there, and it was full of tourists in the Kala. And these women, I think they were American, were talking about one of the women on the Spaniard that was on the beach sunbathing with her topless, which, as you know, is very common. Yeah. And they were like making fun of her. And it just made me so sad, you know, because it just felt like,
the color, we were always alone there.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Yes. So anyways, but yeah, it was just so crazy because, you know, now people know about it, but, you know, back when you were there, it was a sacred little place that. So I also wanted to tell you, it's reading your story. I mean, I want to talk all about that, but I was also really struck because my parents, who are divorced now, but my mother actually lived in El Salvador for 3 years as a child. And my dad would go there as an adult. He was going there all the time for work. And from, I guess, 89 to 96, he was frequently there. And I heard so many stories from them over the years. And, you know, my mom also lived in Honduras. So, yeah. So, you know, I even though I've never been and I haven't experienced any of what they've told me and what you experience, of course, I still feel this certain, it's always sort of been a part of me, like where my mom especially would just tell us stories, and I felt like she wanted to make sure we didn't take anything for granted, you know? And I just, reading your story, it just brought things to a whole other light for me and really brought it to life. I'm just so appreciative that you wrote this book.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And my dad was read it as well. And he told me, you know, he recognized everything you said in there. And especially in terms of how the really poor people in El Salvador are just the most generous people just treated terribly, of course.
They're lovely.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. So I wanted to, before we get really dive deep into it all, I wanted to also ask you, my dad had said that he'd explained to me that in Central American culture that poets are like a really big deal and highly regarded, which is so lovely to hear. And he was saying that he was telling me about one of his dear friends, and I wondered if you knew her. She's a Guatemalan poet called Carmen Matute.
No, I don't know Carmen Matute. I'd like to.
Okay, yes. Okay, I'll send you some info, but she's apparently widely regarded in Guatemala. But I was like, oh, I wonder if Carolyn knows her.
It might have been, but yeah.
But that's so, I wondered how that must have been for you, you know, being American and where, you know, here poets, it's like, it feels like people don't pay attention, you know, as much as they should. I wish they would, to poets, and that sort of paradox of, like, you know, being in Central America where it's like such a big deal.
Yeah, it's really true. Well, I think that was really the key to Leonel's decision to ask me to come to Salvador, you know, because he believed that the best person he could invite would be a poet.
Right. You're a poet and a writer and an activist. And I want to talk to you about so many things, but maybe this conversation we could focus on your incredible story and then also a bit about the art of writing itself. And before we dive deep into it, for anyone listening who is not already familiar with your work, can you give them a brief summary of your extraordinary book, What You Have Heard Is True?
Well, it's a book that took me 15 years to write. After waiting 23 years to even begin writing it, it takes place between 1977 and approximately 1980, mostly in El Salvador and also a little bit in Spain. And there are scenes in the book that occur much later. But the main body of the story happens in El Salvador between 1978 and 1980. It was just before the war, in the time of the death squads. It was a very difficult time, dangerous, frightening, and war was coming. Most people could feel it, could sense it. The protagonist in my book, my friend and mentor and guide of many years, Leonel Gomez, knew that it was coming. He knew 3 to 5 years before it began. He felt that it would be inevitable given the circumstances. And so it wasn't that he was so much a prophet or a seer. It was that he knew how to look at the present very intelligently and carefully and speculate based on the present in what direction things were going. So the book begins with a 27-year-old. I'm 27 and a young North American, U.S. American. I was teaching at San Diego State University in California. And the book begins when I spend a summer. I have already, when the book begins, have spent the summer in Deia, Mallorca, an island in the Baleares in the Mediterranean, where the poet Claribel Alegría was then living with her husband, Bud Flecol. Their daughter, Maya, was a very close friend of mine. And we had decided together to translate the work of Claribel Alegría into English. She had never been translated into English, although she had been translated into other languages. So I joined Maya in Deia that summer. And Maya and Claribel had a cousin. There was a cousin in the family named Leonel Gomez. They presented him to me that summer as a very mysterious man. He had a small coffee farm in Santa Ana. He was a champion marksman, world champion, and he was a Central American, Pan-American champion motorcycle racer. He gave some of his land to the peasants, so they thought it was possible he was with the guerrillas, but some people thought he worked for the CIA. And he wasn't very forthcoming about his life and his person. So he sort of invited this level of speculation and this mystery. And I learned later, much later, that it was deliberate, that he didn't really want anyone to have a good idea about who he was. And he had good reasons for that. And he showed up on my doorstep because Maya had sent him my poetry book and written a letter to him, rang the doorbell with his two daughters. The book, more or less, the story really begins there with that doorbell ringing and my decision after talking to him for 3 days, the decision I took to accept his invitation to come to El Salvador the following January. He proposed that I would learn as much as I could about the country, that he would show me El Salvador and all of its facets and dimensions and all of its communities. He would introduce me to everyone. And then he felt that I could learn enough that when I was back in the United States and the war began, I would be in some kind of position to explain why the war was happening to the American people. Mm-hmm. I, of course, explained to him that the American people don't really know very much about their own poets and don't certainly take them seriously. And we absolutely do not have any influence on foreign policy decision-making. And so, you know, his proposal that I would somehow play a role in this as the war was beginning seemed to me to be at that time rather absurd. It was, almost Don Quixote, tilting at windmills. But he was determined because he said, I don't want a journalist. We will have journalists. The journalists feel that they are objective. They write reportage. They report facts. I want someone who writes in the language of the heart. Yeah. I want someone who can touch people, who can move people. So the story really takes the reader on the journey that I went on with him. And the reader never knows more than I knew at the time. So I don't jump into the present and where I'm this older person who's now remembering. I stay in the story and take the reader through. It's written really, I wrote it primarily for young people, both Salvadoran Americans and U.S. Americans, and for people in El Salvador, especially for idealistic people who wanted to do something in the world, as I was at the time and mm-hmm. didn't know quite what. And also for the Salvadoran children of Salvadorans who came with their parents to the U.S. And they would come to my office in the universities over the years and ask me what happened in El Salvador because their parents don't want to talk about it.
Wow.
They're so traumatized, they won't talk about it. So I realized that perhaps my own story might help in some way. And I had also promised both Monsignor Romero, the Archbishop of San Salvador, who was assassinated in March 1980, and Leonel, who was a good friend of Monsignor Romero's, that I would, the only thing they asked me to do was someday to write about it.
Yes. Yeah. And you did. And you did it so, in such a powerful way, an extraordinary way. I was thinking about how, you know, when you're writing the story, I was realizing after I finished it that, you know, as a reader, we don't actually know, it's called a memoir, right? But we don't actually know so much about you, about the character, all your, you know, whole life story, as we so often do when we're reading memoir. But yet we feel we are there right with you through, and we feel everything through you throughout the story, which is just really extraordinary.
I made the decision to, you know, not provide very much. There's some about life, but not much, because I wanted to be a cipher in a way so that the reader could imagine themselves in that situation. And if too much about me, there were several problems with that. One would be that the reader would, you know, be following me rather than imagining themselves going through this. And also, I didn't want to be in the foreground. I mean, I'm a U.S. North American. I'm telling the story of a war in another country. My main characters are all Salvadoran. And the story is told through the eyes of a naive person, you know, who doesn't really know very much about the world and certainly not about Central America. So, you know, I didn't want to be foregrounded. I wanted Salvadorans to be foregrounded, and I wanted the country and the perils that it was in to be the story. But also the reader would more easily be able to step into the story if I wasn't too dominant, you know?
Oh, yeah, it's incredible. It's truly one of the most remarkable books I've ever read. And, you know, you mentioned something about how the reason Leonel, you know, brought you on this journey really was to, because he wanted you to communicate what you've seen. And, you know, slowly over time, as we follow you, you get more and more into this conflict, and then you do communicate what you witness to people who have little to no awareness of what's going on in other parts of the world, which is such a huge thing. And, you know, I was wondering as I was reading it, like, how did you manage to stay grounded in that context? Because, you know, knowing the weight of communicating that kind of information.
Are you speaking of in the immediate aftermath of the war when I was back here, or in the writing of the book?
I guess either or both, whatever you want to talk about.
Well, the immediate aftermath was both heartening and difficult. It was heartening in the sense that by the time I began in the aftermath of the publication of a poetry book, The Country Between Us, in the aftermath of that publication, I got a lot of invitations to give readings around the country. And in the next few years, I traveled to 49 states, not Hawaii, but everywhere else. And I did a lot of, I was determined to keep going and keep talking, because I was hoping that we could prevent somehow military intervention in Central America. I also was hoping for a diminishment of the economic and military aid the U.S. was sending to support the Salvadoran military government. And so, you know, it was pretty relentless work. But I met people all over the United States who had been somewhat quiet for the years following the Vietnam War. And the Vietnam War had been over about 6 years then. But all of a sudden, they sprang into action, and they organized groups all over the country in support of Salvadorans who were fleeing, and in support of this peace movement, the Solidarity Movement, the Witness for Peace, the Sanctuary Movement. It was really heartening. What was disheartening was that it was very difficult to get some people to believe what was going on there. And in fact, the U.S. government, my narrative, what I saw was not doing any good for the U.S. government policy narrative. So the U.S. government really denied a lot of things that happened in El Salvador for years. They were officially denied. Journalists and others were called fabulists, and they were inventing, they were exaggerating, and so on. And I had those accusations leveled against me, too. And I was young, and that was hard. It was hard to know that my own government was, first of all, distorting reality, and secondly, the policy was completely 180 degrees wrong. And thirdly, that I was, that my work of trying to talk about El Salvador in the United States had come to the attention of very powerful forces in the U.S. So that was all. That was all very difficult. I was in my 30s, so I was sometimes. I never gave up, but I was sometimes scared, sometimes disappointed, sometimes horrified. In the writing of the book, that's another matter altogether, because I think partly I put off beginning the book for 23 years, partly because I wanted some perspective on it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be able to write a full account when I was no longer so involved and so close to the events. But also I knew that I had to relive my experiences in order to rewrite them on the page. You know, in order to bring them to paper, I had to not only write them, I had to imagine them again. To do that, I had to go back there. Mm. And I had to relive them and listen to those conversations again and revive my memories, which were quite vivid of that period. Yes. I knew it was going to be. Some of those memories are very difficult. So, and I would sometimes stop writing because I just was too afraid of the next scene, or I didn't know exactly how I was going to approach it. And it was my first prose book too, which presented its own problems. I didn't really know what I was doing. I had never taken a course in prose writing and of that kind. And I had to make a lot of mistakes. So I really wrote three versions of this book before I came to this version, before I came to the one that would really work. And it was a process of discovery continually while I was writing. Just to give an example, I found some notebooks that I had kept in El Salvador. At the time I found them while I was writing, about halfway through the book, I found them in a box. And I opened them and I read what my younger self had written at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was a very rushed kind of prose. It was all in pencil. It was in these little notebooks. And I thought, my first impulse was to grab the details and rewrite the scene. And then I thought, no, I should reproduce these as they are. Mm-hmm. And because the language in them reflects the language of fear, of terror, of extremity, the fast language, the breathless language. And so I put the paragraphs in from the notebooks, and I called them all written in pencil so the reader would know that we were going into a different kind of writing.
Yes.
And, so that calm narrative that I was working in, not always calm, but it was a narrative, had to give way to something much more immediate. So I had to learn, when am I going to try to present what happened in scenes with dialogue and action? And I did a fair number of those. And when am I going to be able to quickly describe them and, in flashes or in impressions? And, it was a question of learning the economy of the book. When could I take my time and when did I need to move through time more quickly? Yeah. Because if you're covering a period of 2 years, you can't write every moment of every day for 2 years. And I didn't want to fall into the trap with memoir of, and then this happened and then that happened. Because the book really has to have a shape. It has to have a narrative arc. It has to be a story that's shaped so that a reader can go inside and move around, not so that, when a child tells you their dream and they, you know, tell you every single detail, and the telling of the dream is much longer than the dream. I didn't want to write that book. So I think what I wound up with was kind of a poetic thriller or something, you know, because it does read a little bit like a thriller because it, and a little bit like a mystery. But it's a book of prose by a poet. So it has those dimensions. And, so as a memoir, it moves a little bit outside the margins of what one expects of, you know, 21st century American memoir, because I am not the main character and you don't get a lot of retrospection. I don't leap out of the story and consider what happened in the light of the present. You know, I don't supply the reader with my own reflections in this moment. So it's very much the story of then, of that young woman and what happened to her.
Yes, and it almost reads like fiction, but yet real, because it feels so real, and it was real. So it's sort of, you know, feels like it's between both genres in a way, just the sense of it. Even though
I realized I was making use of some of the devices that you find in a novel, such as dialogue. You know,
right.
It should be obvious, I hope, to the reader that I am remembering the dialogue as well as I can. I'm replicating it as well as I can, but I was not using a tape recorder most of the time. So, you know, it's not going to be verbatim.
Well, I really appreciated that actually in your reading, you know, reading it also as a writer myself, like, you know, I spend a lot of time writing, and I appreciated how you often said, I remember it this way, or you would make note of, you wouldn't claim to have, you know, know that the dialogue happened exactly this way, you know, because it gives a writer permission to do the same and not feel like I get stuck a lot where I'm like, oh, I don't want to write the dialogue because I'm worried that I'm going to misrepresent or say something that wasn't accurate. But I love that you wove that in throughout the book.
Well, when I could remember the scene really vividly, I trusted my dialogue.
Yeah, yes.
But if I was vague about it, I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want dialogue to be there. Yeah. And there are other devices, you know, that novels have too, besides the use of dialogue, you know, just the creation of the character of Lionel. I didn't have to imagine him, but I had to remember him and I had to be faithful to him in all of his quirkiness and dimensionality. I mean, he's a very funny man, brilliant, a bit aggravating. You know, I wanted the fullness to be there. And that's what a novelist's job is, to make whole characters that are multidimensional. And so, you know, I couldn't just have one side of him on the paper. So it has to be the man who eats too much ice cream and follows the Formula One races and all of that, in addition to, you know, the man who had given his life to the poor. You know, the only way that I could have felt ethically responsible in the writing of the work was to lay that all out, you know, and include everything, including my own mistakes and my own, you know, moments of falling down, you know.
Yes. And I mean, this book is such an honoring to him. And what an extraordinary person. I wanted to talk to you about, there's this part of the book that really just struck me. It's towards the end when you said, we weren't so naive as to assume we had moved on, as our culture phrases it, or worse, that we had achieved closure. And I just underlined that because, gosh, I felt that so much. And I just thought, like, how could one possibly move on or find closure in these things that you witnessed? And, you know, it has to be really hard to not internalize the pain you're seeing. And I'm sure it becomes part of you in some way. And I wondered if you could speak a bit on, like, how did you protect your well-being in the face of so much pain and suffering then? And then also when you settle back into your new life, you know, what approaches and techniques did you pull on to take care of your own mental health and well-being?
This will sound odd in the contemporary sense, But we didn't think in those terms.
Yeah. Then.
I didn't think about my, I wanted to stay alive if I possibly could, but I didn't think in terms of my mental health. I didn't think for a second in El Salvador about, I maybe should have, but I didn't, about what this was, how this was affecting me.
Yeah.
Because it did irrevocably affect me. We didn't think like that. I mean, we didn't self-care. That's a new term in my life, you know, that a more recent term from the last decade or two, self-care. So we were on a mission. I mean, we were trying to address a really horrible situation. And so we were other directed rather than that much self-concerned, really.
Sure.
And we had principles we followed, you know, evasion, you know, not staying in the same place very often, you know, being very secretive, having more than one name or identity. I mean, we took precautions, but we didn't think of it as psychological self-care. Then when I came home, I was so driven to travel around the country. When I met Harry again in New York.
Yes, amazing story, by the way. So
both of us were just out of El Salvador. And I think that's what drew us together, because we both had gone through something that we didn't know anyone else in the United States who had gone through. So that drew us together. And he understood me and I understood him. And we had both experienced the same terror. So, but we didn't think in terms of trauma.
Yeah.
It was years before I realized that I had been traumatized. Years. And it took some Vietnam vet friends and other friends in conversation with me to help me to understand that a lot of what I was coping with and a lot of my condition came about because of the trauma in El Salvador. And I mean, I think I can't speak for Harry, but I think it was the same for him. It was a slow dawning realization that took years. I'm still coming to terms with that. I mean, I could say that periods of depression, I just saw as depression, you know, so one takes an antidepressant and one does this or that, but I didn't think in terms of self-care. All I wanted to do was keep going. Yeah. So whatever would allow me to keep going, I would do. So if someone would say, well, you really have to take some time off now, that would have been out of the question. You see?
Yeah. I mean, how do you exactly? Because you're in survival mode, right? And you have this mission that you're right. Focused on. I can't, it's sort of the only thing I can like personally almost relate it to is thinking about an ex-boyfriend of mine who was in Iraq, you know, and we would write letters to each other all the time when he was there. And it was unreal to me what he was going through, but I just realized that like he was in survival mode. So it's like, you don't have the luxury of just sort of stepping back and saying like, oh, I need to take care of my health right now, you know? And just like you're speaking to, I think that this stuff just lodges in your body, you know, and it's only probably years later that you can start to really unpack it and see it for what it is and what it's done to you.
I would say that that I found that the greatest cure for that kind of trauma is not to try to address it as a pathology and try to withdraw into the self and try to take care of oneself. And for me, the greatest cure, the thing that pulls you out of it, is doing something for others outside yourself.
Yeah.
And focusing on others and committing yourself to something that's beyond the self. So the self doesn't have a chance to get so much in control and so dominant and, you know, and you don't then so much risk pathologizing yourself and infantilizing yourself or babying yourself. I'm not saying that you shouldn't do self-care. I'm just saying that sometimes the greatest cure for depression is, or that kind of depression that comes from experiencing certain events, is to do something, to do something, you know, to make some difference somehow, to have a positive effect on the world in some, even a small way.
I couldn't agree more. I think that applies to anybody, you know, even who anyone who hasn't even gone through seeing the horror that you've seen. I think just, I know for myself, when I get into a deep sadness, that is actually the number one thing that pulls me out of it, is taking my focus away from myself and doing something, even if it's a small thing, to help lift somebody else's day or life. You know, that is the key thing for me that helps. So that makes so much sense what you just said.
So I think all of that solidarity work and then what followed was the writing was all very salvific. It was all very good for me, and it's how I survived. Mm-hmm. Also, I survived by becoming a parent and creating a home, you know, for another person. And mm-hmm. and that was really the other significant experience for me that I think made a great deal of difference.
Yeah, I it was so heartwarming in the book when you and your husband find each other again. I mean, first of all, what a story. And second, I was so happy because, like you were saying, I can't, like, if I had gone through what you had gone through and seen what you had seen, I can't imagine, you know, finding somebody, well, I guess it's possible, but finding somebody who, like, they won't understand, you know, unless they had seen it themselves, and that find each other and to be able to just have that understanding without even being able to speak about it is extraordinary and just wonderful that you, I'm just really glad you found each other.
Yeah.
So just before we move on from the book, I wanted to just say one more thing, was that this one little part of the book that I found really powerful, I wanted to see if you could speak on it a little bit, was this moment where you have just gotten back, and it's, you know, kind of toward the beginning of this whole adventure that you're on. You have just seen some horrible things in a prison, and you were scheduled to meet with a group of people after that, and you are telling them now that you just want to cancel it. You want to, like, go back and just, like, because you're just,
you my know. Hotel room moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Something really powerful happens to you and leaves you sort of transformed, I think, in that moment. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, the scene, I think the scene does it well, but it's,
yes,
you know, I had been inside the prison in Ahuachapán, and it was horrific. And it's true that Leonel had made an arrangement for me to meet actually some poets back in a barrio in the capital. And I told him I just wasn't up to it. I was tired. I was sick. I was miserable. And what I really wanted to do was go to the hotel and shower and sleep. I didn't want to keep meeting people and doing things. I needed to recover from that scene in the prison. And so he said, okay, fine. You know, he said some other things before that, but I'll save that for the memoir. yeah. And, you know, we have to go tell them though. We have to go, and because people didn't have phones in those days. This was before cell phones, and poor people didn't have phones. And so he said, we're going to drive there. You can sit in the truck and I'll go tell them that you very sorry, but you can't meet with them tonight. And I sat in the truck. And when Leonel didn't come back, he didn't come back. And finally, one of the young poets that I was supposed to meet came and tapped on the window of the truck and invited me to come upstairs, because the wife of one of the poets had just given birth just then. And the baby was in a little box, a little fruit crate thing. And it was a very beautiful scene. And the poets came to me and said, we're so sorry. We heard about what happened to you today. And, you know, we're really sorry. And we understand that you can't meet with us. But when I saw the incredible, you know, the poverty they were living in and the beauty of the birth and the community that they had, and I had to look at myself and say, and, you know, you want to go to a hotel? You know, what is wrong with you? You know, so that was a big change for me. And I realized it that night that I was never going to be tired again that way. I was never going to, you know, turn away from the world toward myself to indulge my own self. And if I'd gone back to the hotel that night and done what I had planned to do, I think I would have spent a miserable night and woken up miserable in the morning. And instead, I woke up really feeling blessed, really, you know.
That's so touching. Yeah. It goes back to what we were just saying, right? It's like when you turn your focus outward instead of inward, sometimes that's it ends up helping you just as much, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. Well, I would love to talk a little bit more about the art of writing with you, as you're such an extraordinary writer. And you are a co-chair with Gloria Steinem of Hedgebrook's Creative Advisory Council. And it's one of my dreams to do a residency there. So selfishly, I asked this question, you know, if you could talk a little bit about your work in that and in Hedgebrook.
Well, Hedgebrook is on Whidbey Island, and which is near Seattle. And it's a beautiful old farm. There's a farmhouse. And the founder, Nancy, gave this farm over to become a place where women and those who identify as women could have time and space to write. Apparently, she had a friend who she was taking a walk with one day, and the friend was having trouble with her writing. And Nancy said, "Well, what would help you? What would you know?" And the friend said, "Well, I just need time, and I need some place, a quiet place." And so Nancy had 6 cottages built on this farm, and they're beautiful little post and beam cottages. And there's a bathhouse and a pump house, and the farmhouse is where everybody gathers in the evenings for dinner. But you have these wonderful little cottages in a cedar forest right on Puget Sound. It's absolutely exquisitely beautiful. And when you get a residency there, and they're open to any writer in any genre who's a woman or identifies as a woman. And they can be beginners or very famous. It doesn't really matter. And they come from all over the world. And with Gloria Steinem, we chair the group, a small group of writers that is there to advise and support Hedgebrook. So hedgebrook.org it's all one word, Hedgebrook, is the website. And I urge you to go and visit and take a look around. You can even tour the cottages there. And it's a really, I wrote a great deal of my memoir there. And I would say that it was one of the crucial places for me. I don't know that I would have been able to get through this without the support and hospitality of Hedgebrook. So I am very strongly supportive of that place. And, the alumni at Hedgebrook is now so accomplished. And, you know, these are voices that might not have been able to develop, might not have been able to be heard. And there's a very, very high proportion of women of color in the among the residents, very high, between 50% and 80%, depending on the year. So, which is really unheard of for these lovely little writing colony.
And it's the application process. I was looking at it because, of course, I want to apply. For the residencies, it's anonymous, right? Like you don't put your name on the application or anything.
Right. And the main thing is they want, you send a manuscript, but you also write a narrative about yourself, and you write, and the question, at least it used to be, why Hedgebrook? Why now? In other words, and they pay a lot of attention to that narrative. Where are you in your life? What have you been doing? And it's women authoring change. So I would say they're very sympathetic to people who are dedicated in some way to change in the world and perhaps have been doing something, have been organizers or caretakers. That's very important. And I think I was first invited there because they recognized all of that work I'd been doing in human rights, and they wanted to give me a little break, you know.
So
it started that way. You don't have to be an activist to go to Hedgebrook, but the narrative matters. You know, how you want to write a moving narrative in your
yes, yes,
It's not just a, you know, they're not just asking for a quick answer to the question. They really want to know your story. And that, so that's important. And you stay there, I think it's about 2 weeks now, the residencies. They can be shorter, but they start up somewhere in March and they go through to November sometime. And and also while you're there with six other women, but that cast of characters keeps changing because they're staggered. Different people leave while you're there and new people come. Mm. So during any given residency, you might meet, you know, a dozen women rather than just six.
Yes.
And we gather at the farm table every night and we have a wonderful supper. And then often we go into the little living room there and we share our work with each other and talk about it. Just give verbal feedback from just listening. Mm-hmm. And it was really helpful to me because to hear what the other women heard in my, you know, what impressed them, what they paid attention to, and just to have a sense that it was coming across, you know?
Yes.
That was really great. So yeah, I like Hedgebrook very much.
Yeah. It sounds like a dream place.
It is, yeah.
And were you and Gloria Steinem friends prior to kind of collaborating on the advisory council, or was that totally separate? Like, were you two coming in separately?
I had met her before I ever went to Hedgebrook, but we got to know each other one August when we were both there for the whole month. So we ate dinner together every night and took walks and went over to the Lavender Farm. And, you know, it was a very important time in my life. And I don't remember how it came about that we were appointed co-chairs, but we were, and that enabled us to do a little more work together. We were more than a decade younger then, maybe 20 years younger. I just turned 70 and Gloria is older than me. So, yeah. You know, I suppose you could say we're getting up there now, but
no one would know it, but
it was really lovely to work with her and it still is. So yeah, I did get to know her quite well at Hedgebrook. We were both working on our books and talked about that and talked about politics and, you know, everything that was happening at the time. Of course, the world is very different now.
Yes. Well, I read in an interview, just back to sort of the writing part too, that you were saying, this really struck me. You said, I went through a very, very first dry spell. I thought that I had sacrificed my ability to write, sacrificed it to publishing, to publication. The price for this was that I was no longer able to write. I desperately wanted my writing back and publication to be gone. I still have the problem of not feeling joy at publication. It terrifies me, which is probably one of the reasons I publish infrequently. There are other reasons, but that's one reason. And why it struck me was because, you know, I take a lot of writing classes and I find people are so often really fixated on the publishing part that they sort of lose joy of the writing part, which are really two separate things. And in reading that, you know, that those words from you, it's so refreshing in a way because it's sort of flipping it. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this and the differences between publishing and writing and what that has been in your life.
I think the passage from the interview that you quoted was one that was, I was referring to the period right after my first book was published when I was 26 years old, and I had a lot of trouble writing after that. I remember feeling very down the day that my book came out into the world, and I didn't understand why. And I called a friend who, John Cullen Holmes, he was one of the beat writers. And he said, no, don't worry about that. Everyone feels that way. He said, all writers feel that way. Mm. Don't worry about feeling let down or depressed when your book comes out. Nobody knows why, but it just happens. And, you know, the cure, of course, is to start writing again. I think it's because something is finished and it's off into the world and it's not with you. It's not yours anymore. You're not changing it. You're not thinking. You're not the one who determines who reads it anymore. It can be read by anyone who can buy the book or borrow the book, you know. Yeah. So, you know, it's, you're much less private with that work. It's now public as publication, right? It means being public, which means anyone can write anything they want about it or think anything they want about it. And people that you don't know and never will know, you know, will be able to read it and have opinions about it. And it's a very self-conscious making thing. And I meet a lot of young writers who their primary goal is publication. Exactly. They want to know how they can get to the point of publication. And I don't get so many questions about craft and about the process of writing and shaping a book. And so I try to tell them, look, don't even think about publication right now. You need to think about your work. Yeah. And you need to, you know, because you certainly don't want to publish something that isn't your very best.
Exactly.
And your very best takes time. And the goal isn't publication. The goal is to write a good work, you know, to write something that really does it, you know, really captures something, or the language is alive. And that's the goal, because publication is, here's what happens. You don't really feel publication, just like you don't feel fame. Yeah. Other people feel it around you. You're the same person, but, you know, circumstances of your life change because of it. So I've not really liked publication so much. I'm getting over that. I'm better now, but you look, I spent 17 years on the last poetry book and 15 years on the memoir. And so these two books, which seem to have come out of nowhere and are suddenly published back to back in 2019 and 20, yeah. I haven't published books of my own work for two decades.
Yeah. It's just so refreshing to hear that, you know, I mean, just what you're just describing. And I have this writing class that I'm taking right now. I think one of the reasons I love it so, so much is because it feels like the most genuine, authentic sort of collaboration and sharing of writing that I've experienced in a class. And the teacher is so wonderful. And I mean, you never hear him talking about publication. Like, that's just not part of the conversation.
Right. Well, that's like a great writing class. You know, there are workshops on publishing.
Yes.
And if you're interested in publishing, you should go to workshops on
publishing. That's it. Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
I just don't think that, you know, I think that there's so much work involved in finishing a good book, that, you know, you can't start thinking about publishing until the whole process is over.
Yes. Yeah.
And then you're ready to present it. You're exactly. ready for it to be seen. And I still believe that good work, that really good work, will find its publisher. I still believe
yes.
that.
Yes.
Maybe not right away, but it will.
Totally. Totally. And just to have that, leave that space in between, and, you know, for that to happen organically and at the right time.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing all that. I did just want to ask one more question about the writing. And I also read in your interview with Poets and Writers that I just wrote down this quote that you said, years were swept away when I broke in. Water main flooded and destroyed our house, which, by the way, has happened to me too. So I know what that's like. Cancer and water. On the other hand, it is possible that these interludes allow the writing to deepen. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like what you meant by that?
Well, when you're torn away from your work, you can say to yourself, well, oh my God, I've been interrupted and I'll never get back into it. You know, this is costing me. Or you can say, I'm having new experiences. My life is changing. My psyche is changing. I'm understanding the world differently. When this is over, I will go back inside my work and I will have something else to bring to it. And I'll also have a little bit more time to consider. So when I went back into my book, both after the house destruction and after the cancer, I saw it differently and I was able to revise it in a good way. You know, I was able to see, I had some distance on it and was able to see what was wrong or what I could make better. And without those interruptions, I might not have had a chance to see those things.
Mm, yes. Thank you for sharing that. I wanted to ask you also if there's, what comes to mind when I ask you if there's one piece of art in any form that has changed your life in some way?
Oh my goodness.
Thousands, big question.
Thousands of works have changed my life and my thinking. I don't think I could break. I'll tell you what a childhood moment when I was taken to an outdoor symphony by a young woman. I was only around 10 and she was a very much older 18 or so. And she went to the symphony and I had never been to the symphony. And I sat there and all of these adults were just riveted and the music filled the air and it was under the starlight. It was really beautiful. And everyone was so serious and so affected by it. And I had never seen adults behave that way. And so I turned toward the symphony and listened, you know, for what it was that they were experiencing. And I experienced it. I still remember that night. And I remember the rapt look on her face. And I think, you know, rather than single out any of the works that I've been affected by in the years since, I would say that first symphony was the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. Mm. I don't remember where they were playing, but it was Under the Stars.
Wow. That's so cool.
And it was my first time, and I'd never been in the presence of a live symphony before. It was one of the first experiences of what, you know, what art meant in the world.
Yes. Yes. Wow. That's so beautiful to think about. Are there, we were speaking about, you know, sort of just the writing and not thinking about the publication, but are there, you work with so many young writers, but are there any lesser known writers that, you know, that you especially admire?
Well, I think that a lot of the most interesting writing right now is being done by writers of color in the United States, young writers of color. And, you know, there were writers like Nguyen Phan Khe Mai, who just published a novel about Vietnam, and Natalie Diaz,
oh, yes,
as a poet, and Jericho Brown, and yes, Ilya Kaminsky, and Fernando Valverde. And there's just so many. Dwayne Reginald Betts, who has a wonderful book about being in prison in the United States. It's called Felon.
Yes.
There are many, many, many. Nomi Stone. I mean, I could just go on and on. Nomi isn't a writer of color, but, you know, I just, young, vibrant poetry communities and prose communities are really, really impressive now. And Garth Greenwell has just become a real star novelist on the experience. He mostly writes about, you know, being a gay man, and it prose is exquisite. So I could just go on and on.
Yeah, well, those are some great names. Thank you for sharing those. And I like to end the podcast with asking some of, I call it like your favorite things list of just some cherished things to you. And just, I'll name a couple things. And if you could just tell me whatever comes to mind. How about a book that has had a lot of meaning to you in your life? Which I know that's such a big question, but maybe just one thing that comes to mind.
When I was a child, there was a book called Girl of the Limberlost, and that had a big effect on me. And W.G. Zabold's work, particularly The Immigrants, had a very strong effect on me. So, yeah.
That's great. And, okay, how about an album or song?
Oh, dear. Well, you know, I'm an old 60s child. I would go back way, way, way back to Jefferson Airplane and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and all my music. Yeah.
I
liked folk music a lot.
Me too. That's my favorite. Yeah. Have you seen, I'm asking because I just saw it. It was the Leonard Cohen documentary that came out, I think, about a year ago.
I haven't seen it yet. No.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. Although I really admire Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, he's extraordinary. Awesome. And how about a place that has a lot of meaning to you?
Well, El Salvador has a lot of meaning to me. And I wanted to point out that Javier Zamora, who's a young poet who wrote a wonderful book about coming to the United States, a book of poetry. He's now writing a memoir, and I can't wait till it comes out. So El Salvador, of course, was life-changing for me. But I think there are other places that have been very meaningful. Whidbey Island, because of Hedgebrook, certainly. And Ireland, there's a monastery that I go and stay in Ireland from time to time. And that's a real refuge for me. And I love northern places. I love the Arctic, you know, the northern world. And the Arctic region is really special. Prague, my father's family is from former Czechoslovakia. And I spent a lot of summers and springs in Prague when I was younger. And I love that city. So I'll just stop there.
Oh, you know, I want to just get on an airplane now.
I know.
I've just been daydreaming, you know, during this time about all the places I will see. I actually just want to ask you one last question. We talked a lot throughout this conversation about the power of sort of turning outward and helping others. You know, in the face of whenever we're sad. And I wanted to know if you can think of just one act of kindness that you've received in your life that felt transformative or just that really had an impact on you.
Oh, there were so many. It's really hard to single. I feel like I've been nothing but blessed with that my whole life, especially from people. I mean, oddly, from people that I don't know, and some had never seen again. When a very close friend of mine died by his own hand when I was 23 years old, I was very poor. I had no money. And this doctor found out that this had happened to me, and he paid for my ticket to fly to the funeral. Out of the blue, he didn't know me. And I said, I won't have a way of paying you back. And he said, you don't have to pay me back. Just do this for someone else someday.
Wow. And then, that's it. That's wow. Thank you so, so much, Carolyn. This has been such a joy and honor to speak with you. And I hope we get to meet in person one day.
Thank you so much. Thank you for talking to me.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Musings of the Artist is audio produced by Aaron Mooring, and the theme music is by Ilan Isakoff.